was a test. I do not believe that's a test. That's valid, Mel. K2KEY, KQLIW.
If we had a similar size vessel, who would have, like, for instance, one with so-called lead content, and another vessel sitting next to it that was pure in some way, maybe plain glass, and he actually did make a comparison of the time it takes to heat the water to either boiling or some point, would we actually see with the one that has a higher lead content a longer period that it would take longer to heat up or not as hot in the same period of time, Dick, over?
I think I see where you're going here, Mel. I think you're making the tacit assumption that the lead-lined cup is a partial shield so that the RF energy doesn't get to the water. If you study the kind of conductivity requirement to make a good electromagnetic shield for 450 megacycle energy, that is a stiff requirement. If I took very fine wire lathing, quarter-inch square wire lathing, and the quarter-inch squares are waveguide beyond cutoff to a 450 megacycle signal with a 4.5-inch wavelength, if I line the cup with 450 with a quarter-inch square wire lathing as I was molding the ceramic before firing it, and then I put water in that cup, then you would get partial shielding of the RF energy not getting to the water, and the microwave oven itself would now run hotter. There would be more reflected energy back to the microwave too. So you'd have to do heroic things to make the cup conductive enough that it acts as a partial shield to that energy getting to that water. That energy is going to get to that water unless you do heroic things, in my opinion. Now, go ahead.
Very good. Just so I bring it up because I happen to have seen it in the paper, and I was wondering if it had any credence to that experiment. All right, very good. Okay, shall we go on and try another one, Dick? Over.
I recommend it to keep your audience happy.
Okay, very good. Let me read over. Here's one I pulled out. I have a question that I've often wondered and would appreciate you looking into. I have purchased a older rig, and I noticed that the transmitter power is rated in terms of peak envelope power. How can I use this to estimate the approximate output power of the rig? Go ahead, Dick.
Okay. In the old days, the FCC would define the output power of a transmitter by taking the voltage you put to the final tube and the current that you put to the final tube, multiplying the two together. If you put 1,000 volts in the final tube and it drew 100 milliamperes, which is a tenth of an amp, that would be 100 watt input. We used to rate input power. And that tried to force everyone to make the transmitter very high in efficiency because they were limiting what you put in, and what you get out, they didn't give a darn. If you were foolish enough to build a 10% efficiency transmitter, you might be putting 1,000 watts into it and only get 100 watts out and creating 900 watts of heat in the room. Well, for a whole bunch of reasons, some number of years downrange, we went to output power rating. And in the case of a transmitter that's running Morse code, you press the key down, you measure the power output, it's easy. But when it comes to voice transmitters, let me drop. Now life gets a little bit more complicated. In the case of an FM transmitter, carrier-wise, it's CW, whether you modulate or not. So in the case of an FM transmitter, taking the output, putting it into a Bird watt meter, and then into a dummy load, very easy to see what is the power coming out of the rig. With an AM modulated transmitter, your standby carrier gives you a certain amount of power, but if you go to full 100% modulation, the power output goes up by 50% during the time you're modulating. So life gets a little bit more complicated with an AM transmitter where you try to rate the power output. Are you going to whistle into the mic continuously during the time you measure the power? That's one way of doing it. Life really gets complicated with a single sideband transmitter. You hook your single sideband transmitter up to your bird watt meter on the dummy load. You press the push-to-talk switch, and the watt meter doesn't move. It doesn't move until you talk into the microphone. Only then do you create the single sideband. The single sideband is the upper sideband of the AM that would have been there if you had a full AM transmitter with carrier, upper sideband, and lower sideband. Single sideband transmitter has eliminated the carrier, has eliminated the lower sideband, only the upper sideband is there. And so now, how do you rate the power output of a single sideband transmitter? You could say, well, I'll shout into the microphone and measure the power output. Well, that's not good enough. You get a high-pitched voice of a female shouting into the microphone, saying ah, versus a male voice saying ah, you'll get a different power output, a different wave shape of that voice. So average power output, when you have some signal going in, like a whistle or an ah sound or hello, you know, it's kind of hard to figure out what the real power is. So what they forced you to do is to use something that responds fast enough, either a peak indicating watt meter, and you can buy a special attachment to your Bird Model 43 that makes it into a peak envelope meter. Or you can observe it on an oscilloscope, which responds fast enough. So in either case, peak envelope power is at the maximum amplitude of the sine wave you're putting into the microphone. At that instant of time, what is the power coming out of the transmitter? They call that peak envelope power. At the peak of your speech is when you're putting out the peak of RF power out of the sideband transmitter. And what is that power? And you're allowed 1,500 watts peak envelope power output for a single sideband transmitter in the United States. And there's a little more complication beyond that, but I think I'm not going to go there right now. K3KUI, K2RI,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Hello?
Hello?
Very good. Well, I have explained it in the past a number of different ways. The rig he's mentioning, this older rig, I didn't bring up the name of it, it's an old Kenwood radio. And basically, the way I have always basically explained it, is the PEP is usually twice the average power. So if you had this Kenwood he's talking about, has a pair of 6146s in a final. They are rated at approximately an input of 180 watts on CW. So if we were to assume 55% efficiency, that means it would be approximately around 100 watts CW. But in the single sideband mode, if it's rated to, you know, at 180 watts in the CW, I would say somewhere around 360 watts PEP. In other words, at 55% efficiency, you mean so you'll be getting about, say, 200 watts PEP. If I know the type of rig, you know, this whole series of these hybrids that came out, you know, they went from strictly old all-tube rigs. Then they started making hybrids, but stuck with the basically the same output circuit using the 6146s. So the way they rated these radios that ran these 6146s was approximately 180 watts input CW stick, and that's the way I worked it out usually. I wonder if that sounds somewhere right, over.
I think I agree with it. It's in the right ballpark. If the voltage waveform you put into the microphone of a single sideband transmitter is a pure sine wave, then there is exactly a 2-to-1 ratio between average power output and peak envelope power. So if I had a transmitter that put out, I'm going to pick a number, 180 watts peak envelope power, and a pure sine wave is going in, and the transmitter is not going into any kind of limiting, no flat topping going on, then the 180 watts peak envelope power divided by 2 would be 90 watts average power into a true RMS watt meter. But now we've got a problem. A unconverted Bird Model 43 is not a true RMS watt meter. It's a very accurate watt meter for signals that are not modulated. You put a modulated signal into a Bird Model 43, it reads higher than average, but lower than peak envelope power. It reads some crazy number in between, which is a function of the waveform, and probably a function of the frequency going into the microphone. You might get a different answer if you whistled into the mic with a 100 hertz tone versus a 3 kilohertz tone. So it is a diode rectifier looking at a rectified voltage going into a Dawson valve meter movement. The Dawson valve meter movement is an averaging device, but the waveform of rectified RF going into it has not been integrated. It has been rectified, and so you'll get a crazy reading. You'll get something in between average and peak. There are ways you could calibrate it for a fixed tone of a fixed amplitude and so on. You could calibrate it, but I don't remember seeing any easy way of evaluating what is the peak envelope power versus the reading that you get on a Bird 43 that hasn't been modified for peak envelope power reading. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Precisely, you're 100% right. I was going to bring that up. That's why I tell you, if you're going to use like the Bird meter, Bird watt meter, if you take it, put it in your rig in CW position, and as Dick just said, if let's say you read 100 watts in the CW position, you can say that it is approximately 200 watts PTP by using twice the average power. So that basically, I think, will give you a very good ballpark. Look at the CW signal into the Bird watt meter or an accurate watt meter, and then double it for PEP, Dick, over.
I'm going to disagree with this one, Mel. When it comes to a single sideband transmitter, the tube itself is usually, and the voltage you apply to it and the drive power you apply to it, that combination and the way you load it. So I'm loading the tube a certain way, I'm putting a certain voltage to it, I'm putting a certain amount of drive to it, and when I'm in the alignment mode, which is usually quasi-CW, I adjust for peak power output by adjusting the tuning and loading on a tube that's got a 6146 in the final. And during the time that I'm running key down and lining it up just like that, I get a certain amount of fade of the power supply. If the power supply under normal sideband conditions is capable of putting out 850 volts, with key down continuous drain on the power supply, it might come down to 750 volts. So I might have 750 volts on the tube during the time I run a key down, and I adjust everything for maximum power output, and I see, in my example, 100 watts. Then I go to the sideband mode, where now the power supply is loaded more lightly. Instead of putting out 750 volts, it puts out 850 volts. Because I'm only loading it periodically with the speech peaks. I'll make sure I get that out without making profanity. And under those conditions, a 100-watt output key down might become 130 watts. There's not a 2-to-1 ratio between peak envelope power and key down power on normal power supply and normal rigs, because the only difference is the exact same tube, the exact same drive in many cases, the exact same loading. It's only the fade of the power supply that makes the difference. And I'll give you a 30% difference on that, but not a 100% difference. Now, where the 2-to-1 ratio comes about is that if I had a true RMS watt meter, a thermal heating type watt meter, let me drop, like an old-fashioned Hewlett-Packard 430 millimeter type watt meter with enough padding to protect it. That's a true RMS watt meter, which really takes the RF energy, turns it into heat, and measures the heat with a thermistor. That true RMS watt meter, if I adjusted it for 100 watts of average power of a sine wave going into a sideband transmitter, in that case, yes, peak envelope power would be twice average power during the sine wave of single sideband modulation. But that's not the way we line up our transmitters when we do a key down versus sideband. It's the exact same tube. He can't put out twice the power because we haven't given him anywhere near enough voltage to do that. That's my feeling on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. Well, wasn't it picky, but I'm saying that basically that's how they rate these transmitters and all. I mean, that's in the manual, it tells you 180 watts CW input. I'm just reading it. In fact, I'm reading the original advertisement on it. 180 watts input CW and approximately 360 watts PEP input. So you figure, like I say, if you measure this, you're most likely going to find it somewhat lower than that. But the rule of thumb on all those radios that ran the 6146s was that the sideband rating was twice what the average, what they used to call the average power, Dick. So it's somewhere in that neighborhood, give or take, over.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit of confusion here because that rig is an older rig back in the days when they rated input power, not output power. And again, if you think of the wording you just read, in the sideband mode, it's talking about peak envelope power versus average when modulated with a sine wave, which is not the way we usually line up the rig. A really smart guy who wants the best fidelity out of his sideband rig is looking at a trapezoid pattern on an oscilloscope while he's putting a two-tone test into the microphone, while he's adjusting the drive, tuning, loading, and whatever of the rig. And he adjusts for the most linear-looking slopes to that trapezoidal pattern. And he's doing a real peak envelope power test, by the way, as long as he calibrates his oscilloscope. So a smart guy does it that way. The majority of us go to the tune mode, which is essentially key down CW, or a slight back off of that. And you're told not to do it too long. You might burn up the tube while you're tuning it. And we adjust for maximum power output during key down and then flip over from CW into the sideband mode and hope that it's properly aligned, knowing the power supply is going to be a little bit more relaxed and the power supply is going to come up a little higher in voltage. So you'll get more power output of PEP than you did key down tuning, but I don't think it's as high as 2-to-1. You're not raising the voltage on the plate of the tube enough to double the power output between the CW mode and the sideband mode. But that's my gut feel on this one, Mel. I'm not first positive. K2LIW over to K2KEY.
Roger. Yeah, well, we're nitpicking it because, you know, as the FCC, of course, used to always, you know, they used to have it, of course, in all the tests, you remember, that the product of the DC plate voltage and the current was known as the average power. Basically, that was the FCC's determination of, you know, for amateur radio. All right, anyhow, but it's approximately somewhere in that neighborhood, like I say, the way I figured it out. That 180 watt rig that you were talking about, this Kenwood, I know it. It will run back somewhere around the neighborhood, I bet you around 200 watts PEP on single sideband. That's all you have to know. Believe me, you're not going to exceed anything with it. Just use it and enjoy it. It was a nice rig, this one. And talking about the 850, I happen to have one. It's basically a very simple, straightforward, and well-working rig with a digital readout. And what's nice about it, they got those 6146s in there that go and go and go. And because you've got the, you know, plate tuning and loading and all those goodies, that you don't usually need a tuner, outboard tuner with this radio. Very good design. I don't know why they ever got away from this design, Dick. Because, you know, sitting in a room with you, and why? What's wrong with you had a couple of final tubes and not have to worry about these transistors that are so temperamental? Over.
You hit the nail on the head. That is an oldie but goodie. Among the rigs that people in the HF world really fell in love with, the Kenwood 450 and the Kenwood 850. Boy, there were lots of people who fell in love with that rig. It was a real battleship, tough rig. You could use it for contest after contest. And the thing just kept playing and playing. and the output tuning and loading controls had lots of range. You almost did not need an antenna tuner. The craziness nowadays is that we insist on the rig being small and no tune required, which means you've got to force the standing wave ratio not to be above 1.5 to 1, and all the space you saved with a smaller rig with no tuning, you're putting it all back again, the tuning and the extra space, in the antenna tuner. So I'm not sure we've really profited in that area. A smarter guy will buy one of these older rigs and be happy with it. And 6146s, I think those tubes are going to be around for another 50 years. What do you think, Mel?
No doubt. They are excellent. I have a number of radio. All the Collins rigs use 6146s, starting with in the 50s. Soon as they came out with the 6146s, Collins jumped on those tubes and had a lot of success with the F-lines and all the KWM2 series. And every one of those radios has top ratings. And I've never seen anything wrong. I mean, if you're going to carry the radio, it's going to be in a mobile, you know, all right, but that's another problem because you need to be plus, you know, for the place. And that's another problem with tubes and all, and mobile and all, and current trains and all the other factors, like you say, size. But if the radio's going to sit in your radio room, what's the difference how wide or high or the weight, you know? I don't understand, you know, what the derivation are. But I think it's just that they found a way of saving money because no doubt it's less money to make the newer one radios with the solid-state finals and not worry about, you know, the plate supplies and all that they have to get involved with, and especially now most of these radios, they don't include a power supply. You've got to purchase this 12-volt power supply, the one that, you know, that the company suggests, or go out and buy somebody else's. But you'll notice that the power supplies are optional now, where these radios had a built-in thing over.
And that's a pain, as I see it. The rig you're listening to right now is Kenwood TS711A. It's got the 110-volt power supply built in. I can feed this rig 12 volts or 110, and I'm on the air. It's not super compact, but by my standards, it's an oldie but goodie. Maybe you should open up the next mailbag, Mel.
Very good. All right, so there we are with with Rick. We've gone forward some ways, maybe backwards in other ways. Like Dick just said, it's obvious that when you add the tuner, there goes the size and everything. We're back where we were, basically, if you want to talk about being compact. All right, let's see here. I wonder, okay, if I bought one of these azimuth elevation rotors and used it on my 10-meter beam, would it be an improvement? Because a friend of mine says that the ionosphere at 50 megahertz is a definitely a improvement by using this, by tilting the antenna on 50 megs, it does make a improvement. Will this also carry over to my 10-meter beam by using, in other words, if he uses one of that rotor, azimuth elevating rotor, do you feel that it's going to be a plus in on 10 meters thick as it is on 50 megs over?
Hold on now, back up a little bit. Lots of people have a theory that on 6 meters, you tilt your elevation, or on 2 meters, you tilt the elevation of your Yagi antenna above the horizon, below the horizon, whatever, that you're going to get an improvement for long-range signals. Lots of guys believe that. For the most part, it is not true. You'll get the longest range communication over the horizon signals if the peak of that beam is aimed at the horizon. That's where the signal is coming from. All long-range signals are coming from an elevation angle right at your horizon, and that's where you aim the beam. You can aim the beam above that if you want to. In the most part, with rare exception of some crazy nearby sporadic cloud or whatever, you're not going to see an improvement, in my opinion. Lots of people believe they see an improvement. You know, they go up there one day and loosen the wrenches, loosen the bolts, tilt it up a few degrees. For the next couple of days, they get a stronger signal. There happened to be better propagation, and they think that tilting the antenna did it. Let me drop. On HF, the situation is even more ridiculous. Unless you've got a zillion feet of Yagi on 8210 meters, you've got a very broad vertical beamwidth. The antenna itself typically has 30, 40, 50 degrees of vertical beamwidth of your antenna. And now you're going to tilt that great big wide beam above or below the horizon, and that signal you're getting off that ionosphere from that DX station is always coming from your horizon. You make a poor picture of the Earth. You'll draw a picture that's 8 inches in diameter, and you'll add 2 more inches of atmosphere above that, and you'll put the ionosphere above that atmosphere. It's a great diagram to demonstrate a principle. It's dead wrong. You take that great big globe that you've got sitting on your desk, the globe of the Earth, which maybe is a foot in diameter. That globe has a diameter of 8,000 miles. The height of all the air of the atmosphere that counts is 6 miles. That's the troposphere. 6 miles out of 8,000 miles. That atmosphere around this Earth is not much thicker in reality, as a scale model, than the paint that's on that globe. The paint that's on your globe is about as thick as the atmosphere is. And you're talking to a signal bouncing off the ionosphere that's a little bit above that, and it's half a world away. That signal, when it gets to you, is right on the horizon. So to tilt the antenna in elevation for a terrestrial communication, I think it's a bust. I might be wrong, but now you know what it's based on when I say that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hi, Jeff, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I've heard this pros and cons back and forth so many times, and, you know, I don't know what to make of it at times, Dick, and I'm only going to tell you why of the experience that I've had. Maybe because of the design of the antenna, this one large diamond antenna, this was a big, big antenna. I mean, this was 512 feet between two towers that were each 100 feet tall, and then two other towers that were 275 feet apart. Now, on the two towers that were 275 feet, they both were 100-foot towers also. This guy in Texas that I visited outside Houston, of course, everything is bigger and better in Texas. When I was at NASA, he was a ham, and he took me to see his setup there. And he had enough room there to put a city in there, a property he had, so he could get away with all this. And he was tilting this big loop. Now, this loop was covered the HF band. And he says he had 2 inches at each of the two towers that were 275 feet apart. So, in other words, you look down on this thing, it was in the shape of a big diamond. And when he tilted this loop, he could actually get improved gain. Now, is this because the loop is basically, are we dealing with a quad or some sort of, antenna system of some sort, because of it, when you take a horizontal box like this and do, or a diamond like this and tilt it, will it actually produce gain if it's tilted properly, Dick, over?
Okay, now, there's a fairly different case. Your loop antenna has a azimuth and elevation beamwidth not too different from that of a dipole. Dipole has got something like 78 degrees of horizontal beamwidth, and your loop is in that ballpark if it's a medium-sized loop, and it's a little bit broader than that if it's a small loop. When you tilt and rotate that loop, I think the main thing you're doing is you're adjusting polarization of reception. And because that signal hitting the ionosphere is twisting a number of times due to Faraday rotation, It's twisting in polarization, such that quite often you launch a signal in New York, and you're horizontally polarized, and your buddy in London hears it vertically polarized when he's listening to the stronger signal. So the tilting and rotating and whatever of that loop, in my opinion, is favoring polarization. The major determinant figure, the major determining factor of what is your elevation takeoff angle on your transmitter is not the beamwidth of the antenna, not the pattern of the antenna. The thing that's got 90% of the influence, I'm picking numbers here, but I'm trying to generate a principle, 90% of the influence of what is the elevation angle of your radiated signal is the number of feet that antenna is off the ground, the number of wavelengths that is off the ground. Because the mirror image of your real antenna above ground and the one below the ground, that's a great big moment arm. It has a lot of influence on determining angle of elevation that you radiate. And the beamwidth of the antenna itself is a minor factor. So when he's tilting and rotating, I think he's favoring polarization, impedance match, how much is radiation by the cable, all kinds of funny things are going on. But it's not what you think, in my opinion. I could be wrong on this one. K2KEY, K2LIW.
One more thing I was going to say to you about this. I remember when I was there, and he demonstrated it. He was saying to me, now, I'm not convinced, but he was saying to me that he could see a gain on 20 meters with this antenna. Number, it's going to be, I forgot, let's see how many wavelengths, because it's a full wavelength on 160, so it's going to be, what, five wavelengths or so on 20 meters. He says he could get a gain by tilting this upwards of 20 dB over a dipole, dBd. Now, is that possible, or is he meant maybe dBi, I mean? Is either one of these figures possible, Dick, in your estimate, over?
Absolutely not. Gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared. That's the bedrock of the antenna measuring science. I can solve that antenna for area. Effective area of antenna equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. A simple dipole antenna with only 2 dB of gain on 80 meters has an effective area, real effective area, that with good laboratory instrumentation you can measure and confirm. An 80-meter dipole, which the wire itself is casting a shadow on the ground of about a square foot. But that dipole, when resonated high enough in the air, has an effective radio area of 8,500 square feet. That's the area of a dipole on 80 meters, with 2 dB of gain, 2.14 dB of gain, gain of a dipole over isotropic, 2.14 over isotropic, 0 dB over dipole. 20 dB more than that would be 100 times more area, 100 times more than 8,500 is 850,000 square feet. We're talking about square miles here, many square miles. So the mathematics tells me I'm awfully doubtful. Where is all that area coming from all of that gain? I doubt it, Mel. Now, as he tilted and rotated, let me drop, and he started off at some reference position, like the dipole, like the loop antenna, parallel to the ground at some particular altitude up, and as he gives, he's tilting and rotating, because he was in a polarization node before, and now he did something to make a change, and the signal got 20 decibels stronger, I'm going to believe that. That doesn't mean it's got 20 dB of gain over ISO. It just got 20 dB stronger than the partially known condition he started off from. But 20 dB of gain, 80 meters, 850,000 square feet. I can calculate that in square miles if you like. And do you believe he's got that much radio area in his backyard? Yeah, he's a rich guy and he's got a big antenna. But is it that many square miles of effective receiving area? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, let's take it this way. On 160 meters, he had on 160 meters, you had two wavelengths on 160. That would translate to what? Four wavelengths on 80 meters. Eight wavelengths on 40. And approximately on, this was on 20 meters, would be 16 wavelengths on 20 meters. If you had 16 wavelengths on 20 meters, the diamond is held in a parallel position between the two outer supports, the 512 feet away, the two towers, and then the two towers that pull the center of the diamond, the closer towers, they have the winches on them, so this whole thing just pivots. That's basically, it does not rotate. If I went to 16 wavelengths on 20 meters, is it possible, or is this still fantasy, over?
Okay, Gunter Hahn, TL6WU, has a formula where you tell him how many wavelengths long is your Yagi antenna. He will tell you exactly what's the maximum gain you can get in decibels over isotropic. So I think you're asking me if he's got a boom of a Yagi that's 20 wavelengths long. That's a lot. Can it get 20 dB of gain? I think it's in that ballpark. I may have misunderstood your question, but I think that's what you asked, Jeff. Now, let me think now. My boom was a little shy of 12 foot long, a little bit over 2 foot wavelength, so I had five and a half wavelengths of boom length on 432 gave me something like 16 dB over isotropic. 16 and a half dB, RAW 19 Yagi 432. So, 5 wavelengths of boom, 16 dB over isotropic. Each time you double the boom length of a Yagi, you get close to 2.4 dB of gain increase, if everything is tuned just right. So, we've got enough round numbers here by which we can make an estimation, Mel. K2KEY, K2RAW.
This is K2KEY. I was just curious if such a thing could be achieved because of it was a big antenna. I mean, you stand there and you could barely fathom the size of this thing. I mean, it was. I just don't know how anyone even put a thing like this in their mind. I mean, it's bad enough by looking at what you had there and. Probably somebody's going to outdo it somewhere or another. It's just beyond comprehension. And other than that one that I looked at also, that time where the guy had a truck, he uses a rotator, this pivot, and then he had like this four-wheel vehicle that was at once a Ford truck that he took all the body off and everything and just... remove the engine and replace the engine with electric motor, and this rotates on whole array also with elements. I don't know if you've ever seen that one. He was just featured a few times in a number of the magazines with the Mentor EME system with this huge system to rotate it there. So listen, I can say I never would say no. Because these guys just going and going. All right, shall we look at something else? We're running out of time, over.
Yeah, go for it.
Here we go. I always look for a New Ham question. I'm a New Ham, and I don't understand. What is this term, gray line, supposed to mean, actually? What am I actually looking at when I'm looking at the gray line? Well, you're not looking at the gray line is a term. But, all right, Dick, you want to take it first, over.
Yeah, this is a pure HF question, and I'm not much of an HFer, but I'm going to take a quick crack at it, and you're going to correct me. As the Earth turns, half of the Earth, the sun is shining on it, and the other half, the sun is not shining on it. Right at the transition, where the sun's on the horizon to the guy that's standing on the ground, to the east of him, the sun is shining. To the west of him, there's darkness. He's right at the midpoint between the two. He's at the place where it's not bright white, it's not black, it's gray. He's on the gray line, the place where the sun is just starting to set, so to speak. That's important because the guy that's at high noon has a whole lot of solar radiation, ultraviolet, coming down to his part of the atmosphere. It's lighting up the D layer, and the D layer on 80 meters is very absorptive at high noon. The first QSO I ever made on CW 80 meters with a 25-watt transmitter was a guy that was a couple of miles away, and the signal was weak because it was huge D layer absorption, and I was doing it at high noon. Let me drop. Talked to the exact same guy on 80 meters with the exact same antenna and transmitter at midnight, and his signal would be gangbusters, but it was super weak because of D layer absorption. So at the gray line, you're getting a significant rapid change in propagating condition. The D layer is rapidly disappearing, and the higher layers of the ionosphere are starting to become effective to you. So if the path that is followed by the signal between point A and point B goes through the gray line area, certain propagation advantages take place, is my understanding. I've only got a partial understanding of that. Give us some more of that information, Mel. K2KEY, a real HFer. K2RIW, a VHFer.
Hey, the K2KEY, I'm a little of each. You know, I try to cover the entire spectrum from DC to microwave. So I know, I guess, a little bit of each. Experience with a little bit each one of them and their idiosyncrasies. But simply put, I think the best way to say gray line, I don't know why they even came up with this gray line. I think we should call it the twilight zone. What do you think of that name, over?
I like it. Twilight zone sounds good.
That's the point where the Earth is actually, it's like between daytime and nighttime. I think they used to refer to that passing point where, you know, we're just switching from day to night. I think that's what they call the linear. Maybe I most likely pronouncing the words wrong because I'm a champion at that, at pronouncing words wrong. I believe they call it the lineage of daytime from nighttime. Is that the correct word before I go any further, Dick? Over.
I would call it the delineate. That which delineates between night and day is the twilight zone or the gray line. I agree with it.
Now, what happens? Actually, what the, I mean, if you want to talk what the classic astronomers usually would refer to it, it's plus or minus the minute, 30 minutes, plus or minus 30 minutes on either side of the local sunrise and the local sunset. So we have about, maybe 2 hours of gray line actually a day. In other words, 30 minutes from sunrise to sunset, from sunset to sunrise. We usually have 1 hour, in other words, a total of, 30, plus or minus 30 minutes on each, so 1 hour and 1 hour. So it actually adds up to, like, we'll say that 2 hours of this twilight zone or gray line. And it's been found that an HF propagation along this line is the most efficient time because of the reason that the D layer of the ionosphere is minimal or non-existent then, and as the signals are not absorbed as they would during the day. In other words, at this point, the D layer, which is usually responsible for our so-called DXing and all, is minimum or non-existent as it follows the gray line. I don't know. Did I say that correctly, Dick? Over.
I think so. So if the path, let's say, for instance, the gray line is between midway between me and my buddy in London. It's right in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, is the gray line. I think that means on certain bands, I'm going to have medium good propagation between me and him, because the signal is going through that gray line. As long as I can get past by the way, we've got to worry about the gray line of sunrise versus sunset. I'm talking about sunset now. Or am I talking about sunrise? Ain't sure. If it was sunset, he's in the dark and I'm still in the light, and midway between us is the gray zone, the twilight zone as you called it. And I think there's certain advantages in the propagation between me and my buddy in London if the gray line is between us. But I'm not positive on that one. Back to you. Maybe you've experienced it.
Actually, this is K2KEY. Get on 75 meters and to Europe. And we get on around, if you get on around midnight to 1 o'clock in the morning, you can usually work Europe fairly well. So you get to approximately around 5 hours difference. They always tell you, just getting light here, Joe. We just see, you know, the little bit of glow in the atmosphere. Then as it starts, the sun starts to come up about 1 o'clock in the morning here, 1:30 in the morning here, depending on the season. Now, that's another story. Let's talk about also the season, because the position of this path actually does vary with the Earth's inclination to the sun. So, you know, we got summer conditions and winter conditions that we have to take into consideration, Dick, over.
I highly agree with that. So, I think you're saying midnight might be the best time to talk between here and Europe, which means they've been in the dark for such a long period of time that the sun is starting to rise. Therefore, this time of year, when it's midnight here, and the sun rises there at 5 a.m., they're at sunrise there, and I think you're saying you've had the most amount of ionospheric propagation, the least amount of D layer for the most number of hours, and I think you're saying midnight for us might be the best band opening on 80 meters, for instance, to Europe. Is that true?
Exactly. That's it. That's the best time. Get on right about now. In the next 15, 20 minutes, you're going to hear a good part of Europe pouring through around 3795. And it's basically one of the only bands right now that you're going to hear Europe that well, because of the situation of another factor, propagation and everything that we've been dealing with now at the low part of the cycle. But we also have the situation again that the that's actually the frequency, optimum working frequency that you may see referred to as the optimum working frequency, and it's also the relationship, as we call it, the MUF, the highest frequency that can be used for a transmission between two points without reflection of a regular ionosphere layer. Basically, that's getting into something else. I don't want to jump into MUF, Dick, because that also is digging in here. But the north-south pole, basically, the inclination, the north-south pole, at different times of the year, really, you know, switch the kind of the D-layer absorption and refraction and the number of skips that will vary by the season. Over.
Yeah, on a good ionospheric year, peak of the sunspot cycle, you get a hell of a lot more band openings than we get during the low point. We're near the minimum right now, isn't that true, Mel?
Sitting on zero for quite a while right now. The number of sunspots that have showed up, usually, again, sunspots. Now, another story about sunspots. New sunspots have this peculiarity of having a reverse in their polarity, the magnetic, in other words, if the old sunspots have a, what they call it, south pole, the new sunspots have where the south pole is the north pole. I don't know if I'm explaining that right, but they call it a reverse polarity, so you can determine new spots from old spots. So far, the few new spots that have showed up have not really taken hold. They are up in a different... usually the sunspots, I understand, when they take hold, or whatever you want to say, establish themselves, they seem to drift towards the equator of the sun, but will start out either in the western or eastern hemisphere of the sun, pick over.
Yeah, throughout the 11-year sunspot cycle, the whole sun that runs at one particular magnetic polarity, you could say it sort of goes through zero, and the next 11 years, it goes through the opposite magnetic polarity in the sun. So the end of one sun cycle and the beginning of the next sunspot cycle, you'll see that the sunspots themselves have a magnetic polarity that can be measured with a radio telescope, the right kind of optical equipment. You can measure the spots themselves, what is the polarity of the magnetic field coming out of the sunspot. I may have it backwards, but I think the brand new sunspots start off at the equator. At the tail end of the sunspot cycle, the sunspots are numerous and further away from the equator. And when the ones further away from the equator disappear, and you get brand new ones near the equator of the opposite polarity, that's the way that you know the next cycle has begun. I think we've had a couple of false starts of the new cycle, and I don't think it really has gotten rolling yet, but I might be wrong on that one. We've got about 4 minutes left, Mel, and the bewitching hour is coming. This was TechNet number 1,100. Where's my number here? Can't even see my number. I wrote it. There it is, 1,186. The 1,186 TechNet that began in September of 1982. Here we are, 25 and a half years, and it still exists. We think, Mel and I think, there's still a couple more questions to be answered. So, on assumption, we stay healthy. Us and the merry group of guys that support us will be back next week, and we'll be digging a little bit more into the mailbag and answering some more of these radio mysteries, or attempting to. The price is right, so if there's some errors, don't get mad at us. You don't have to pay for this. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye for now. K2KEY, you got it, Mel.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, the sunspots, there's a couple of them show up, seems like, once a month. And the disc rotates around, and they stay a few days, and then they're gone again. So this is where we stand right now as far as the new cycle is concerned. All right, as Dick says, listen, we do this spontaneous, you know. None of this is rehearsed, so if we make a mistake, don't hammer at me. I just with emails and tell me that we don't know what we're talking about. We do the best we can. I don't research out any of this beforehand, so it's all spontaneous, as Dick said, off the top of our heads. And we try to be as accurate as possible, so we slip here and there and all. Please excuse us. With that, thank you all for joining us. We'll see you all next week, hopefully, as Dick says. If everybody we can make it, then we'll look forward to doing it again. 73s all, have a great weekend, great week. This is K2KEY. Take care, Dick.